Vergeten ze.
And this is Stanton St. John.
Stanton St. John. And I'm William Hager. And this is April the 28th, 1994.
This is for a biography that's supposed to be posthumous,
yes.
Not to be published in his lifetime. He says, après moi le déluge.
Yes.
That means that you can be as candid as you wish.
Yes.
It also, I should assure you, these conversations are confidential.
Yes.
I don't have any desire to... they go beyond this tape recorder. And I think I wanted to just get from you, in a very undirected way, a sense of the narrative of your friendship and acquaintance with him over your lifetime.
Well, goes
when does it begin?
Well, although we were contemporaries at Oxford, I don't think we ever met then at that time. It begins really in America during the war. He was at first in New York when I was at the embassy in Washington, and he used to telephone to me from Washington, from New York, from time to time, with what was obviously fascinating news, but I hadn't got the wavelength, I couldn't hear what he was saying at all. It took me a long time to get it. And then the end...
You simply couldn't understand
it. I couldn't understand it.
It was so quick.
Went so fast, and rather convoluted, and I wasn't used to the way he spoke. I am now, of course. But that time, for a long time, I was baffled by it. However, I got it wavelength in the end. Then he moved down to Washington, to the embassy. And then I saw a lot of him.
And what, at that point, what position did you occupy in the embassy?
I was one of several first secretaries in the embassy. But
this is in Halifax, is that
right? In Halifax this time, that's it. And for quite a space, I was what's called a head of chancery, acting head of chancery. And so Isaiah's famous reports used to come to me on their way to the ambassador. And of course they were fascinating. But I said to Isaiah, all this is very wonderful, but is it true? Isaiah replied, it's true to a deeper level.
It's a wonderful story. Is it? Why were you skeptical about its truth?
Well, it was so extraordinary. And so clearly derived from some very inner level of this United States administration to which most people didn't have access.
Yes.
That I could hardly believe it. But I didn't dare to change it and send it on unaltered up to the ambassador, who sent it off. And it was very fascinating. I don't know what his sources were. There was one man called Pritchard, a very fat man, was eventually called up. I mean, he said, they scraped the bottom of the barrel, and now they've taken the barrel itself. He was certainly...
Pritchard was one source.
He was one source. I don't know who the others were.
Well, he saw Frankfurter.
He saw Frankfurter. He must have seen people like Joe Alsop and Walter Lippmann. Berlin was around then, yes, he was. Yes, he would have. So then we did see a lot of each other then.
Was he, did you feel even then that he was unusually well-placed and well-connected?
I did, yes. Well, I mean, he couldn't have produced these reports if he hadn't that extraordinary series of friends and acquaintances all over the administration.
Were other officials in the embassy producing similar kinds of reports?
Nothing like that, no. No. It was far the best source of political information that we had. And he was always bringing marvelous people to see us. I remember he produced Weizmann to talk to me, came to see why Weizmann, to call on me, I can't imagine. But he did. He was the most impressive man I've ever met, I think. As our relations with the Jews were a bit awkward, because he would report to us what they were saying. And of course, at that time, they were... we were being very tiresome about Jewish immigration into Palestine. And so they were pretty hostile to the British administration for obvious reasons. And as Howe knew all this and reported it to us quite properly, but it was slightly embarrassing for him to be reporting to the enemy, as it were. But I think he managed to play both sides successfully without betraying either.
But did you feel his loyalties were occasionally under strain on the Palestine question?
They must have been. He's not, I think, a very keen Zionist, as far as I know. I mean, he goes there often and has very good relations. I don't think it ever occurred to him to go and live there or anything like that. But I think it was, I think for moments he did feel awkward, but he was certainly reporting very fully on what his Zionist friends told us. Yes.
But you never heard him at the time in Washington in 42 or 43 express, shall I say, Zionist opinions to you?
I don't remember his doing that. I can't remember his ever doing that.
Yes.
Best of my recollection.
I don't want to lose the thread of these reports.
Yes.
Can you describe their chain of influence? That is, did Halifax read them, or did he simply pass them on?
Halifax certainly read them.
Yeah.
I don't remember, as I could deal with this, I don't remember Halifax ever querying them or discussing them with us. As far as I know, he just signed them and sent them off.
Yes.
But he must have found them very useful. Background in his dealings with the administration.
And then they go back to Whitehall, and what is their circulation?
I should think fairly wide. They were not, in a sense, top secret. They were not, didn't involve any national security or intelligence stuff or anything like that. I should think they were probably rated confidential, which meant that they had a pretty wide circulation in Whitehall. They were not outside. I think I'd guess that, I don't know, but I would look that, one could look that up. But I should think they would be confidential rather than secret or top secret.
Would you say that they honestly had any influence?
Well, hard to say. I think they must have influenced Halifax's attitude with the administration when talking to them. And I think they must have illuminated Whitehall as to what reactions of the American administration would be to given situations, which of course was extremely important then at all times, particularly then. And I would have thought they must have influenced people's attitudes, if not their actions.
Yes. But chiefly you think with Halifax, not necessarily in Whitehall.
Well, we know the Prime Minister read them. And I think, I'm sure the Foreign Secretary did. I'm sure they were very widely read. People were then very anxious to know what the Americans were doing, what their reactions would be. And this must be one of the major ways of gauging that, I think.
Were you instrumental in getting him to Washington?
No, not at all. No, it was just decided. Is Aubrey Morgan still alive?
So.
I don't think he would have been a very good source about Azar. But I'm afraid, I think he probably did. He was Azar's boss in New York. There was a wonderful moment when Aubrey wrote a letter to someone in Washington, to me or someone, saying, I feel it my duty to bring to your attention this very unfavorable report on a member of our staff here. And that was a headline, Berlin Blasted. I think it was Aubrey Morgan who did that. I think so.
It was a vast embassy.
It was a huge embassy. I mean, there were three ministers, I think, or more, six ministers, I think, and countless councillors and unending press secretaries, and others on the way down the huge pyramid. And this is quite apart from the colossal Whitehall representation in Washington. Every department then thought it ought to have its representative. The Board of Trade, the Ministry of Labour, the Ministry of Defence, of course. Everyone thought they had to have a once more.
I mean, it is an extraordinary moment. I suppose what I'm inviting you to reflect upon is what an extraordinary moment it was for you to be in an embassy in the middle of the war, in the sense at the height of somehow British power in this century, at the heart of the empire that was soon to replace it. I mean,
yes. Oh, it was very interesting. I remember Ronnie Campbell, who was a senior of the minister, saying to me, the Americans have got into this bad habit of treating us as a junior partner. And I said, but aren't we a junior partner? And Ronnie said, well, no, the Commonwealth, the Empire, all that, where they're equal. And I said, I rather think those days are over. Yes. But Ronnie was an older generation, rather unwilling to accept that thing.
Yes. But you felt, you could feel that even
in the war.
Oh, yes,
it was very noticeable, yes. Then, we were always around the begging bowl, you see. And least we had to be supplied by them with all the necessities of life. It was a terrible moment when one of the lists of lend-lease was supply of sanitary towels. And this caused a furious reaction from someone in the Manchester because they can't cover their own guns, God help them.
Yes, that general feeling is...
And the general feeling that we were relying on them for the ordinary necessities of life. Although we had, I mean, as far as the actual fighting goes, we had as many people fighting as they had in those days. They were all supplied by, largely supplied by them.
Yes.
By them.
Besides his dispatches, I mean, can you describe what the routine at the embassy was that would involve him, the routine of meetings and kind of sessions together and things, or did Isaiah pretty well go his own way?
I think he rather went his own way. I don't remember him. And Halifax wasn't the one to have meetings of the staff. He liked to see people individually, one by one. And I don't remember any meetings of that kind. I would go and see him, and other people would go and see him, but one by one. And I know Isaiah must have been in to see him from time to time. Isaiah could tell you that. But my recollection was that there weren't meetings at which he was present, and all the weren't meetings, period.
Was he regarded as a very kind of odd fish in the embassy?
Well, we felt we were very lucky to have him, I think. We all thought he was very exceptional. He obviously wasn't the sort of typical run-of-the-mill diplomat. He was different from that. Lillian Hillman was writing a play in which a diplomat was involved. She was a friend of Isaiah. She said to herself, I've never met a diplomat. I must have one to put in the play. Can you produce one for me? And I said, well, I'm not a diplomat. He produced me. I was entertained lavishly by Lillian Hill, given tickets to Oklahoma as long as possible to get in those days. So it was a very great advantage to me. And I think that rather, I can't think of anything more to tell you about Washington, I think.
Did you feel that in Washington you actually became friends with us?
Oh, very much, yes, I did. Yes. I remember a wonderful lunch with him at that French restaurant, I can't remember what it was called, Escargot, or something like some French name. Isaiah said to me, do you believe in absolute moral principles? A question I hadn't given any thought to before. But thinking about it, I decided, yes, I did. And Isaiah said, and you obviously, or a wicked mess, not an Etonian. I love categorizing.
Yes. Did you feel that was fair?
I think it was fair enough, I thought. And we did become friends, yes, we did.
What do you think he liked in you?
I don't know. We Latin liked the same sort of things. We liked music. And we had sort of Oxford background. We knew a lot of the same people. So, and we did become friends. I see him much less now than I used to, but one time I see a lot of him.
What is, sticking simply to Isaiah as a diplomat, I mean, do you think he had sort of basic good political judgment?
I think he did, yes. And I think he wasn't, as I say, he was keen scientist, but he wasn't limited by that. He was interested in all these things. And I remember Freya Stark was around then. He was very, although she was very obviously pro-Arab, he got on well with her, and that was all perfectly all right. wasn't narrow-minded in any kind of way. I think his interests are pretty general, pretty wide. I think he has very good political sense, I think. Very strikingly so, I would say.
Because, in fact, that's often very rare in intellectuals and academics.
Very. No, I think he is very rare in all sorts of ways. And he has, I think, a very good, clear political sense. You only have to read what he writes about people like Churchill or Weizmann or anyone like that. That he has a very acute, well-based political sense, I think, very striking sense, I should say.
What you said somewhat earlier, that you had been introduced to Weizmann by Isaiah in the embassy
yes.
in Washington during the war.
Yes.
What impression did Weizmann make upon you?
I think he's a really, really authentically great man I've ever met. Well, not quite true. But Churchill clearly is an authentically great man. But I have qualifications, my views of Churchill, none about Weizmann. I only have one superficial interview, but he struck me as tremendously powerful, tremendously intelligent, and very sort of upright, honorable. Great man, I think, really
yes.
great man. I think.
Did you get any sense of the rapport between Weizmann and Isaiah?
No, they weren't. Isaiah brought him in and left, so I didn't. But it's clear, I think they were friends. I think they must have got along well. I'm sure they did.
So, you were together. It's appalling that a biographer should not have these dates absolutely at his fingertips. 42 to 5.
I came back to London in 44. I'm not quite sure when I saw him. I think he came back fairly soon after that, I think. I saw him quite a bit then. I was going to the Potsdam Conference, the secretary delegation.
Yes.
And Isaiah was supposed to be coming too. And one day Isaiah appeared on the doorstep of the then living little house, London Terrace. Isaiah appeared on the doorstep, shaking his fist in the air. He'd been banned from the Potsdam delegation by Eden,
yeah.
who said, I can't have that Isaiah chattering around the place.
Oh, really?
It was a typical superficial Eden approach to things. I have a very low opinion of Eden.
And but, in other words, Isaiah, this was in London.
It was in London. It was back by then. This was in summer of 45, was the Potsdam Conference.
And the house is in St. Leonard's?
St. Leonard's Terrace.
Terrace, right down by the hospital.
The opposite hospital,
yeah.
Yes.
And now you see Isaiah...
He's shaking his fist in the air.
Because he's just heard.
Just heard that he wasn't to come. Well, had been on the strength and then taken off it. He was very,
yes.
very rightly. Very
he shaking. Was upset about not going to Potsdam.
He was, yes, very.
Mentions it.
Yes, yes. That was Eden. I heard afterwards Eden's... I asked Bob Dixon, the private secretary, why was Isaiah taken off? And he said, oh, secretary state doesn't want Isaiah chattering around the place.
Yeah.
I don't know whether Isaiah ever knew that, but that was apparently what it was.
Was at any time, just to go back to Washington, during the war, were his Russian connections, his Russian language made use of? Was he a kind of conduit or a contact point with the Russians?
I don't remember that he was, no. I don't
know. But presumably at Potsdam he would have been useful.
He would have been very useful, I think, yes. Yes, he would, I think. Yes. I think he would. The Russian delegations were pretty formal.
Yes.
Gromyko was there. Gromyko was in Washington when I knew him that time. And he and I and Chip Poland to a sort of drafting committee, I think.
Yes.
And that was on that kind of formal level. There wasn't very much sort of meetingness.
Yes.
I mean, there were dinner parties of a formal kind with toasts and all that, but there wasn't much informal contact.
Was it at Potsdam, or no, it must have been earlier that you made the acquaintance of Bolin. You must have known Bolin.
I knew Bolin in Moscow during the war, before the war.
Yes.
Before the war. And I knew him in Washington during the war. And then at Potsdam, and then of course we were in Paris together. We were both ministers at the respective embassy.
Yes.
And then we were both ambassadors in Washington
sure.
and Moscow at the same time.
Yes.
So when he was sent to Manila, I was rather nervous. I would be going everywhere he went. I mean, American ambassador Manila makes some sense. I mean, British ambassador Manila makes no sense
at all. So he doesn't go to Potsdam, but you do. And then instead he goes to Moscow 45 and has his meetings with Akhmatov and Pastanov.
Yes.
And is there until early 46.
Was that in 45? Oh, I'd forgotten that.
late 45, January 46.
He stayed with us later in Moscow, of course.
Yes, later. In 56. I want to get to that. Yeah. But first, in that immediate post-war period, do you ever recalling him say to you, I'd really like to stay in the Foreign Office?
No. I never heard him say that. No.
You thought he was always destined
I
to return?
I thought he didn't go back. I always thought so. I don't think he would have been happy in the Foreign Office. I think he would have known that, really.
Why do you think he wouldn't have been happy?
Well, no scope for his particular activity. He wanted to write, obviously. He wanted to talk freely. He wanted to see. I don't think he'd have fitted in the kind of formal framework. Wouldn't have suited him, I don't think.
Something about his temperament as well?
A bit. I think he was... His likeness to say what he thought and talk all the time. And his great, I thought his great ability to talk, of course. I mean, better talker than a writer. He's a good writer, but he's a far better talker. A great pity he didn't have puzzle around all the time. He's a marvellous talker.
Do you think there are people in the Foreign Office, in the embassy, around, who thought rather like Eden, that he was a chatterbox, clever, but just not?
I think so. I think not sure the Foreigners would have welcomed him for that reason. Eden, judged him as very superficial, thought of him as a chatterbox. And some others might have thought that too, I think, really.
But you didn't?
I didn't. No, no. I could see he was much better than that. Of course, anyone who talked to saw him regularly could see much more than that. But I thought of him as a don, really.
Yes.
I never occurred to me that he'd want to stay in the Foreign Office. Do you think he did? Have you heard that he did?
It crossed his mind, and there's really? A certain amount of correspondence in 45,
really?
46, as he kind of
really?
Evaluates things in his mind.
Really?
Tries to
really?
I think, like you, he was not seriously tempted. I think he felt temperamentally.
Yes, I wouldn't have thought it was a serious option for him. I'm surprised if he really thought that.
So when do you pick up acquaintance after that, after 45?
Well, I stayed with him in New College one or two occasions, and when he was still there before he went to All Souls. And I used to see him from time to time, but never very. He was in Oxford, I was in London. We didn't see each other. But we always remained friends and corresponded occasionally. I'm sure I'd kept his letters. I never keep letters ever. Always regretted it, but I haven't. So I don't think I have. We sort of saw each other from time to time in London or in Oxford.
Can you remember any of those occasions in the sort of post-45 to mid-50s?
No, I can remember staying with him in Oxford, and we were asked by John Wheeler Bennett to lunch at Garsington. And then there came another invitation to lunch with the Trees. Ditchley. Now, so I decided that Ditchley was more interesting than we went there instead. Next morning we met John on the station at Oxford, furiously, not unnaturally.
Yeah, so
I don't remember anything very... I don't think much that he said. I remember a great flow of talk, but I can't remember anything particular that was said.
Were there recurring things that you talked about or themes that you felt you had in common with him?
Suddenly, no. I can't think of one. We talked about Oxford, of course. We talked about the Foreign Office. We talked about people a great deal. And his great theme of characterizing him is great, equating Oxford colleges with various countries. Christchurch, Germany, Belgium, France. No more than France. No, Baylor is Germany, Morden is France, Christchurch is America, Corpus is Denmark.
Can you remember on what basis a place like Magdeburg would be regarded as France?
Well, France is luxurious, rather corrupt, strong communist element.
Jolly good. And Baylor?
Baylor was sort of earnest and not very high thinking and rather unruly. Liable to be a bit hysterical. Christchurch is very rich, rather stupid.
And Corpus is just very small.
Corpus small and very virtuous and upright. I added one to that. I put many one of my own. And all souls was like the Vatican. He has no subjects and claims a special relationship with another world.
Oh, that's very good.
You always love to do that sort of thing. You'd say Alan Bullock is the Bulk or Boo of Oxford, that sort of thing. Comparing this with that.
Yeah,
love
yeah.
that sort of, yeah. sort of thing.
And then you, because you've been posted to Moscow before the war, did you have sort of Russian conversations?
We did a bit, yes. I don't remember him talking very much about Russia. Come on, darling.
I'm coming off. Oh, God.
Don't move, don't.
Yes.
There. Oh, I didn't see you had that. That big.
Okay. Why did your Russian conversation?
I don't remember talking about Russia to Eisenhower, I must say. I never thought I was going to go back to Russia, and I didn't.
So it wasn't the sort of special subject?
It wasn't a special subject for me. I was very surprised and I sent back to them. I didn't expect to go there at all.
And tell me the history of that. When are you sent? You're sent 50...
53.
53.
Just after Stalin died.
Yeah.
I was in Paris. Knew I was going to move somewhere.
Yes.
Didn't know where. And I never thought it would be Moscow because they generally sent all Italy figures to Moscow.
Yes.
And I was 46 and I didn't think it was my level at all. I don't know why they did that, for some reason, I was sent there. But it was very splendid promotion, and I was very thrilled to go there. My Russian was always really bad and never got much better, unfortunately.
And Isaiah comes to see you in 56.
Isaiah came to stay in 56, I think. I came back to England in 55 with Bulgarian Khrushchev, and we came to Oxford. And I said to Isaiah, you must come now because we in the Bolands won't be there indefinitely.
Yes.
And when we're both there, friends of yours, you better come now, soon.
Yes.
So we arranged him to come then, that time. And he came, and it was a great pleasure, I must say. And he spent half the time with us, and half the time with the Bolands.
Yes. Well, we felt tremendously grand to have two ambassadorial residences.
Right, yes. That was lovely. It was very enjoyable. But all of us enjoyed it very much.
What was the atmosphere in Moscow in 56, as you recall?
Well, it was...
How much thaw is there?
The thaw was on. It was very different. I mean, when I was there in the 30s, we never had no Russian contacts at all, except servants and the people at Archimedes and teachers, among whom people were constantly disappearing. And you never know whether they would be there or not. In the 50s, this never happened. There were no disappearances. And all that was done. And there were a lot of contacts.
Yes.
And the...
Don't you forget the strength. And Isaiah was just married,
yes, he was, yes.
Yeah. And was this the first time you met Aline?
I think, well, because I met her during that visit to... And when it was Bulgaria and Khrushchev, she was around then. I think it was the first time I met her. I think it was.
Just to get the Bulgana and Khrushchev visit, they come to Oxford in 55. Is Isaiah involved in that?
No,
I
don't think he was. But
he was not presented to them, or he didn't.
I think he must have been, because I remember I was talking to Isaiah and Aline on the lawn at New College. And when they, and Bulgana and Khrushchev had gone ahead up the steps, there was a loud explosion. I thought they'd be at the moment I leave them.
They've been
bombed. It was only sort of, flashbang thing.
Yeah.
You have some, you got some sugar?
Fine.
And we were there, I was talking to them about arranging there when they were coming to us. And then he must have been there at that reception for, and then Waldron, you got him as Vice Chancellor. So the reception was in New College.
I see.
For them. And Isaiah must have been at the reception.
Yes.
But I don't remember his playing any very active part.
Yes. comes in 56, do you arrange a program for him, or does he kind of basically go on his own?
He arranged it himself, I think.
Yes.
He was very active, and he telephoned all these people. All the, he used to go out and telephone from telephone booth, not from the embassy.
Yes.
That was wiser. Not likely to be bugged.
Yes.
And he was full of enthusiasm and interest, really.
What did you feel about his attitude to the regime? Did you talk politics? Did you discuss
his attitude? He's obviously very hostile to the regime, as we all were.
Yeah.
But we thought it was a moment when things might improve. And they were, in fact, improved. They had improved. But then they had improved very much. Constant contact. Politburo would turn up at embassy parties in quite large numbers very often.
Yes. And he remembers when the Politburo turning up.
Turning up, yes. It was a great contrast to Washington. In Washington, you could meet anyone you liked except the bosses.
Yes.
In Moscow, you meet the bosses, but nobody else, really.
Yes. Because nobody lower down the totem pole can speak, they're tongue-tied.
But in Washington, no diplomat, regular never meets the president, can't all meet the Secretary of State.
Yes.
Do you meet anyone else you want to?
Yes. What was it like living in the embassy in 56?
Well, it was not bad. I mean, housekeeping wasn't very easy. But we were very luxuriously looked out. It's a nice house. As you know,
it's the one right opposite
the Kremlin.
Yes, and it's that house that...
That's where we lived in. And we had plenty of servants. And we could manage life very easily, really. Well,
did you feel spied upon?
Oh, yes, very much.
Never mind.
It doesn't matter. I mean, all our servants are spies, but it's a good thing having spies. Servants, because they're clever than the average domestic servant, and they can't leave. Well, you know they're spies. Well, anyway, treat them as spies.
Yes.
There's no problem.
Yes.
You must be careful what you say.
Yes.
There are not very many diplomatic secrets. That's an exaggerated idea.
Yes. It's an important trip in Aline and Isaiah's life, because I think, unless I'm much mistaken, it's their first trip abroad as a married couple.
I think it was, yes.
What impression did they make upon you together on that trip?
Marvelous. Except that occasionally Isaiah forgot that he had a wife, and he had to say, what about me, or going to the library?
Yes.
What shall I do? Isaiah took a bit of time to get used to it.
She seems horribly interested in being there.
Russian,
didn't she?
Does she learn Russian?
Yes.
She was studying it then, yes. And it's on that visit that he sees Pasternak.
Yes. As he came back one day and said, Pasternak's written a novel. I said, sure, he doesn't write novels, he writes poetry. But he said he's written a novel. His whole life has gone into it, and it's the most wonderful thing. And yeah, Isaiah had read it all through, sat up all night reading it, and 2 hours by the end, it was wonderful. And Isaiah...
This was in the embassy?
In the embassy, yes. And I think it was, anyway. And it obviously made a deep impression on him. That's called Sir Trivago. And that was the first, I think, I'd ever heard of Trivago.
Yes.
What else he had? He was obviously deeply moved by it.
Roughly how long did he stay with you?
Well, I got...
We've
got the... This book is there, we can find it. Look at it. Yeah. He stayed with us, I think, about 10 days or so, and then when they went on the boat to the boat.
I won't ask you actually what impression Chip Boland made on you, because he was a very important figure in Isaiah's life. So what kind of man was he?
Splendid man. He's I think one of the best ambassadors I've ever encountered. Very strong personality. Very splendid man to work with, I think, really. He knew Russia very well. He spoke fluent Russian. He'd been an interpreter, you know.
Yes.
And his judgment. And he ran the most efficient, well organized embassy. Very high bar indeed. Splendid man.
But a sort of quiet, thoughtful person, or very forceful?
Very forceful. He loved. He's a real, only in the interest of Russia, I think. Passionately interested. Talking about Russia and what the Russians, how it was going to go, what's going to happen next.
Yes.
And he really was very deeply sort of involved in it.
Much more than you, for whom it was a fascinating posting, but yeah. It was not sort of your life.
No, it wasn't my life. It was very much his life, I think. But he was extremely able operator.
Did he come across as a sort of very grand East Coast patrician? Because he was a kind of grand figure.
Well, I suppose he was a lovely sort of hearty figure, you know. I mean, felt he was sort of cheerful and lively and high-powered. And he was tremendously kind of reliable. I mean, the terrible occasion, Suez occurred at the end of my time in Moscow. And there was a Kremlin meeting where Khrushchev said the British and French governments were a Kremlin reception for Africa. The British and French government behaving like bandits. I thought they were, but I thought he shouldn't have said so to him, partly to which he invited the British French ambassador. So I persuaded the French ambassador to walk out. And I looked around, and there Chip had rounded up all the other NATO ambassadors, all of whom were frightfully anti-Suez, as he was, and made them come out after us, which was very...
Oh, that's very good of him.
Very good. Yes. Very good. And the French ambassador was a silly man, was very pro-Suez. It was all difficult to get him. He said, "Il faut jouer le jeu diplomatique," he said.
And he said, "The hell with that."
I said, "That's the deal. Out we go." But it was but that's the kind of, it was privately, it was extremely critical to Suez to me, and I didn't feel inclined to defend it either.
Yes.
But publicly, the British Embassy was then being besieged the next day, and he wanted to come round with his flag.
Besieged,
yes, where they were.
Demonstrators.
Yeah. And he wanted to come round with his car with his flag flying, and I told him not to. And he was very splendid there.
And his wife was
she was very attractive.
Important figure for Isaiah, a good friend of his.
Yes, she was. She was, since almost more the kind of East Coast patrician, she was very...
Or was she?
The Thayers were very, sort of, very much good Philadelphia family. I think it was Philadelphia. And she was delightful, absolutely delightful person. They were a marvelous couple. I always felt slight inferiority complex to Chippy. They're so able and so good. I felt he's higher power than I was. But I admired and liked him very much. He was a very, very good colleague.
What was the period of your posting in Moscow?
53 to 57.
57.
Yeah.
What an incredible time to be there.
It was a very interesting time, yes, just after Stalin died. It's like wonderful to be there, been there in Gorbachev's time, Khrushchev's time, though not quite so stirring. Totally interesting too.
Yes.
It was a great change after the deep freeze.
Because my father went to...
Your father came with Mike Pearson.
Yeah, that's right, in 55.
55. When they made the Russians made a set at him, tried to make him come over to us. Extraordinary story.
But my father was very, very much affected by Khrushchev taking him aside in Yalta, not him, but Mike Pearson, and saying, we cannot run this society on terror.
Yes, yes.
And saying it with obvious conviction, just that, we cannot go on like this.
Well, that was the great change. The terror did end, and then other things happened. But the terror ended when Stalin died.
Yeah.
There wasn't a sense of terror in Khrushchev. They were very frightened still. Well, they might come back. But there wasn't, in fact, no them. Nobody was being arrested and put in concentration camps then.
Yes.
But I remember there was a painter, Sarayan, we wanted to buy a picture of his, and they'd done it too expensive, but we asked him to the embassy, and he said many, many years would pass before I'd feel safe to go to the British embassy.
Right.
That was the kind of feeling of the unofficial people, that really wasn't safe to go to foreign embassies. We might come back. Never did. I mean, even in Brezhnev's time, it was sort of, Lenin said two steps forward, one step back. It was only one step back. It wasn't two steps. They went back to Stalin.
Yes, yes.
I won't tell you, but it wasn't really Brezhnev. It was kind of stagnation or something on there. It wasn't terrible either.
Yes.
It was a, they possibly eliminated, thank goodness.
Yes.
I could come back now, different form. But it didn't then. There was a big, big difference, really.
Yes. It's terribly important to Isaiah's story, in a way, that he had seen the Russian Revolution from firsthand, and
yes,
was therefore inoculated against any tendency to be sympathetic to the Soviet experiment,
yes,
from the beginning.
Yes.
I think it marked him out in distinction to many members of the Oxford left in the 30s,
yes,
and the,
yes,
British,
yes,
left in the post-war,
yes,
period.
He was never, no, he never was a fellow traveller. Trace a fellow travelling of any kind. Never.
Speaking of all that stuff, McLean was in the embassy in Washington.
He succeeded me.
Oh, so, yes.
I knew him quite well.
Yes.
He stayed with, I came to stay with, before we were married, he stayed with Alice's family. And we all knew
came
him.
To dance, came to dance. My feelings were slightly hurt that he never asked me back to Wales.
He was a, he was very, man, way more attractive figure.
Was he?
Well, he's very good looking and very,
yes,
good, soft voice.
And just an ordinary.
Perfectly ordinary for run of the mill Foreign Office character, but rather high powered kind.
Yes.
All right.
This is the guest book of the British Embassy.
No, it's our own private one.
Oh, your own.
No.
The haters all their lives,
yes,
gracious, isn't it?
Yes. From Shanghai till now, started.
Fantastic. And this is the 56 period.
Yes.
What I see here is that between August 5th and August 22nd in 1956,
yes,
Isaiah and Aline,
yeah,
Berlin have signed their names, listing their houses, Headington House, Headington, Oxford.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just by chance, above it, I see 16th to 18th June, a rather round, young hand of someone called Douglas Hurd.
Yes.
Oh, really?
From
I'd forgotten
British
that. Yes, 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 yes. He's on his way back from Peking, yes.
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 Isn't that marvelous? And you've kept that your whole...
And we've kept that.
We only had people who came to stay, not people who came to meet us.
Yes.
Just did the people
who actually stayed tonight.
Yeah. And then there I see Douglas J.
Yes,
yes, he came again and again. We,
yeah,
asked
and Douglas came.
Yes.
He's a very old friend of mine.
Only one shirt, shocking.
Really?
Yeah,
only one shirt, gracious.
Yeah. One to pair of dirty grey trousers. Scruffy figure, Douglas.
Well, thank you very much for finding that. Sorry. I wish my parents had done that, because that seems to me an absolutely,
yes,
brilliant thing to have done.
It, but it used to be much more interesting when people had addresses and I mustn't blame for that shame.
No.
Father.
Oh, I see. There's Washington. Yes.
I think many people have stayed in China.
Enter more, if possible.
But you see, that's what you've seen them often. That's how they used to be. But
yes,
that was my opinion.
I don't think Isaiah ever stayed in Washington.
Oh, gracious, so this is really a family
that's
tradition.
I don't think Isaiah ever stayed with in Washington, did he? No. Can't have, no.
No, because he had the house, and do you remember all the Washington friends, that great stout man?
We talked about Pritchard.
Yes.
Yes, Pritchard's very important to the story.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.